This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Okay. Bismillah, wassalatu wassalamu ala rasulillah. First, I want to say a welcome to everyone who's joining us online. I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Adrian Woodsmith. I'm the coordinator of student life here at Zaytuna College. Imam Zaid is one of our professors here at Zaytuna. Last term, he taught a course on the introduction. It was an introduction to political science. And one of the books that the students read for this course was called The Irony of Democracy. Inshallah, today's lecture will be on reconciling the irony of democracy. In addition to welcoming you to this talk, we'd also like to welcome you to the Zaytuna College Library here. And we'd like to remind you that this is an important project that's going on here in America right now, and especially in the Muslim community. Zaytuna College needs your support in three areas. First, we need your du'as. So please keep us in your prayers. Second, we need your financial support as we move to the next stages and are trying to purchase a new building in the next coming year. We have an event in San Jose on the 18th of February, so please join us if you'll be around. See the Zaytuna Facebook page or the Zaytuna website for more information. And third, if you are interested in applying, please consider Zaytuna and see the website and the Facebook page for more information. Now, without further ado, here is Imam Zaid Shakir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalat wassalam ala Sayyidina Mursaleen. Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam tasliman kathira. Rabbana laka alhamdu kama yanbaghi li jalali wajhik wa li azimi sultanik. Subhanaka la nuhsi thanaan alayka anta kama athnayta ala nafsik. Allahumma salli wa sallim wa barik ala Sayyidina wa Habibina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallim tasliman kathira. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Alhamdulillah alladhi hadana lihada wa ma kunna linahtadiya lawla an hadana Allah. Alhamdulillah alladhi anzala ala abdihi alkitab wa lam yaj'al lahu iwaja. Alhamdulillah rabbil alameen. Naam. So before going any further, before I forget, I'd like to reiterate what Adrian mentioned in his introduction. If you're anywhere in the vicinity of San Jose, California, on February 18th, to join us 6:30 at the Fairmont Hotel in San Jose, building Zaytuna College brick by brick. So this is a fundraiser and consciousness-raising event to help pave the way for Zaytuna's move to our permanent home, what will be, inshallah, ta'ala, bi'awnin wa tawfiq wa taysir min Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, our permanent home. So as was mentioned, this particular talk, and the first of two, actually, this subject, inshallah ta'ala, will be divided into two lectures. The first, the sort of theoretical foundation and framework for looking at how we as Muslims in America can develop a viable American Muslim politics. And so as opposed to trying to present somewhat of a theoretical framework and then trying to go through practical steps that we can take to build a viable, identifiable American Muslim politics and shortchange the latter, I decided to really deal with that latter subject, developing a viable American Muslim politics in a separate lecture so that we can really get into that subject and present some concrete ideas for our collective consideration, inshallah ta'ala. So this lecture, originally I entitled it Resolving the Irony of Democracy with a question mark. And it was subsequently changed to just the irony of democracy in lieu of the fact that it seems so difficult to solve that irony. So proposing that we can resolve it might have been, in the view of some, a bit pretentious. Hence the question mark, though. So can it be resolved? And as was mentioned, this arises from the course I taught last semester in one of the course books or textbooks, The Irony of Democracy, and a sense of frustration that often arises when the subject is approached. And we'll get into it, if the elites control everything, aren't the masses therefore helpless? And so this is a question we want to look at. But before doing that, we want to reiterate for those who are in the class and present the idea for those who were not, what is the irony of democracy? So we start by defining irony. So irony is when a word or concept is used in opposition to its literal meaning. So we sometimes will hear something, we say that it's ironic that you would say that, because what you're saying contradicts the meaning of your words, or your words contradict their apparent meaning in the context that you're using them. Or the idea that they conveyed is contradicted by reality. So this is the essence of irony. Democracy is from the word demos, the critical word rather is demos. Demos being the common people, and more specifically, the common people in a Greek city-state, in the ancient Greek, the time of the ancient Greek city-state. So the ordinary people were called, referred to as the demos. And so democracy, the rule of the ordinary people. So it's from here that the irony of democracy arises. Historians, political scientists, and others who have studied political rule, be that what appears to be popular rule, be that dictatorship, totalitarianism, whatever form of authoritarianism, whatever form of political rule we look at, have discovered that inevitably a small elite will dominate any political system or any polity. And even in a system that labels itself and advertises itself or presents itself as a democracy, a small elite will dominate that system, and it is their decisions that lead to the perpetuity of the system itself. So a system called a democratic system, such as here in the United States, inevitably, according to political theorists, will devolve into the rule of a small elite. And perhaps more significantly, the nature of the rule of that elite will articulate itself based on the interests and values of that elite, and not the interests and values of the overwhelming mass of common people. So here's where the irony of democracy exists. A system that posits rule, as is commonly presented, of, by, and for the people, depends on the decisions of a small elite whose values and interests do not reflect those of the people. So this is the essence of the irony of democracy. The system is called the rule of the people. It's advertised or presented as rule, government rather, of, by, and for the people. But in reality, it's not the people whose values or whose interests are critical for the preservation and perpetuity of the system, rather a small elite whose interests and values are reflected in the nature of the rule. Now, as we went through those introductory ideas in the textbook and in the classes, those who were in the class, who did the reading, which everyone did, as reflected in the outstanding test scores, generally speaking, you encountered the name Robert Michels. Robert Michels European political sociologist, actually, who posited an idea called the iron law of oligarchy. And that is that any effort to organize human beings will inevitably culminate in the creation of a small group that will dominate that organization. So the iron law, because in his research and presentation, this is inevitable in any human organization. And a state being a human organization is no exception. In fact, states, because they are large organizations, require bureaucracies, and bureaucracies are even more prone to the iron law of oligarchy, in that in a bureaucratic setting, major decisions have to be made daily. And depending on the nature of the bureaucracy, sometimes several times a day, there are critical decisions that have to be made. Consulting a large, disorganized body, as represented by the people, in that context will be unrealistic and literally impossible. So if to keep this organization running, we need to make decisions on an hourly basis, at minimally on a daily basis, to consult all the people who are represented by this organization is impossible. To get in, to develop the communication networks, to track them all down, to communicate the issue, to get the feedback, and then to record that, and then act on the basis of it in a large organization is literally impossible. So in that, states breed bureaucracies. And then that, in that, bureaucracies are organizations within organizations that are even more prone to the iron law of oligarchy. All of this points to rule by a small group, an oligarch. And in Michael's view, any claim of a democratic system is a farce for this very rule. So in this country, actually, more insightful people will argue that, in fact, America is not a democracy. It is a what? Republic. It's a republic, not a democracy. It's republican rule, representative rule, and not direct democracy. Now, in that, this situation prevails in the nature of organizations and states, and particularly here in this country, activists, organizers, students can become very frustrated in that elites control the media. And the elites controlling the elites that control the media, it is their interest that determines what is news and what is newsworthy. Elites control the electoral system, and it's their interest, their money, their organizational organizing ability that's critical to the determining who gets elected, or in some instances, who gets selected, as in the selection of 2000. And it is their interest and their values that determine what sort of policies are pursued, and that elites control interest groups. And their interests are more determinant in terms of the range, setting the range of policy choices. Again, this points to a small oligarchy. And that oligarchy, in many instances, as we see in the issue, issue after issue of special interests and their role in our political system, they work for themselves and they advance their interests, be that Wall Street, so a small elite spends their money in the presidential campaigns to lobby Congress to urge the type of legislation that led to the massive bailouts that benefited themselves. So it wasn't that our political system is so magnanimous that our political leaders decided, you know what, those guys on Wall Street really deserve help. We should reward their recklessness. We should reward their irresponsibility. We should reward their vulturous behavior with $1 trillion of taxpayers' money, adding to the public debt, burdening future generations of ordinary people, the demos, with a mountain of debt. What a great thing to do. Let's go for it. You know, it didn't go down like that. It went down in that these guys have paid me millions of dollars to attain to office. And if I stand any chance of being reelected, it's in my best interest, as I see it, to do their bidding. Hence the bailouts. So Congress is an elite, as we study, an elite in and of itself with its own narrow worldview, and it is itself, its membership, beholden to other elites. The president is primarily a manager or arbitrator of a competition between various elites. And we can see that in President Obama's State of the Union address last night. How many of you listened to President Obama's? All of you didn't listen? Astaghfirullah. You're excused. There's no political science course this semester, so. But one example of arbitrating between the interest of disparate elites. The oil industry, a very powerful and influential elite, is competing against the environmental interest groups, the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Foundation, etc. So if everything goes to big oil, the environmental groups control a lot of votes. And those votes will be turned against the president, potentially. If everything goes to the environmental groups, big oil controls a lot of money. And that money will be used to help defeat the president in the election later this year. So what do we get in the speech? We get the mentioning of the rejecting the XL pipeline, a victory for the environmentalists, but we get a promise to open up 75% of our public land for oil exploration. So a payoff, if you will, to big oil. So in the same speech, we get these two contradictory messages. A message to the environmentalists that would be deemed very positive, a message to big oil that for those who support big oil would be deemed very positive. And we'll come back to this issue a little later, inshallah ta'ala. So the president is arbitrating the disputes. The Supreme Court itself is an elite, nine people. Nine people who can nullify the will of a popularly elected president by declaring an executive order or a bill that's been signed into law by the president to be unconstitutional. That can negate the will of a popularly elected Congress. That can negate the will of popularly elected school boards and state legislatures or city councils. So, nine people. That's an elite in and of itself, but that elite also serves the interest of particular elites. Because in that, presidents who represent their political parties, and their political parties represent a platform of divergent interest groups, and presidential Supreme Court appointments are highly political. And we can see the so-called liberal-conservative breakdown in the court reflecting the appointees of liberal or conservative, Democratic or Republican presidents. So even that elite of nine individuals currently is responsive to other elites. And we see that in decision after decision that comes out of the Supreme Court. So bureaucracies, again, as we mentioned in the context of the iron law of oligarchy, constituting an elite, So if we look at all of this elitism in the system, it's very easy to become frustrated in terms of what can we as the masses do? What can the advocates of change who want to change this system somehow do? And are there any meaningful prospects of change? So this is something we want to look at. But before we do that, we want to briefly detour and take a look at the Quranic view of elite rule, or the Muslim view of elite rule. The Quran bears out the principle that rule in a society, in a polity, will reflect the control of an elite. So this idea has credence in terms of it reflecting the Quran. Ibn Taymiyyah, in his book on political rule in Islam, as-siyasat al-shar'iyyah, mentions at the very beginning, I think I photocopied those pages for the class last semester, that the basis of Islamic rule is founded, predicated on two verses in the Quran. The first, which is the second of the verses in order, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَتِيعُوا اللَّهَ وَأَتِيعُوا الرَّسُولَ وَأُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ. So, O you who believe, which is half of the verse in reality, O you who believe, obey Allah, obey the Messenger, and those in authority amongst you. So Allah Ta'ala is urging the faithful, the masses of the believers, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, to obey أُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ, after Allah Ta'ala and the Messenger of Allah. وَأُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ. Who are the أُولِي الْأَمْرِ? Most of the commentators, the overwhelming majority, mention الْعُمَرَاءُ وَالْعُلَمَاءُ, the political leaders and the scholars. The political leaders and the scholars. So Allah Ta'ala is urging the masses, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, O you multitude of believers, أَتِيعُوا اللَّهَ وَأَتِيعُوا الرَّسُولُ وَأُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ. So obey Allah, obey the Messenger, and those in authority over you. So this argues for this dichotomy between the elite, أُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ, and the masses, أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, the believers. So Allah Ta'ala also urges, though, the political leadership to be just in their dealings and their rule over the believers. So this is the first verse. إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُكُمْ أَن تُؤَدُّوا الْأَمَانَاتِ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهَا وَإِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ أَن تَحْكُمُوا بِالْعَدْلِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ نِعِمَّا يَعِذُكُمْ بِهِ إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ سَمِيعًا بَصِيرًا. So Allah commands you, referring to the leaders, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْمُرُكُمْ أَن تُؤَدُّوا الْأَمَانَاتِ إِلَىٰ أَهْلِهَا, that you deliver the trust to their rightful possessors. وَإِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ. And so here this tells us the address is to the leadership. For Allah Ta'ala says, وَإِذَا, and when you rule or judge between people, that you do so with justice. وَإِذَا حَكَمْتُمْ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ أَن تَحْكُمُوا بِالْعَدْلِ. Most excellent is what Allah commands you to undertake. إِنَّ اللَّهَ نِعِمَّا يَعِذُكُمْ بِهِ. Verily Allah is all-hearing, all-seeing. إِنَّ اللَّهَ كَانَ سَمِيعًا بَصِيرًا. So Allah commands the two sides in this relationship that you have responsibilities and then you have to work together. When the political systems break down, when the masses and the elites do not work together. So Allah Ta'ala says, and Ibn Taymiyyah mentions this verse also in his introduction, اللهم صل على رسول الله وتعاونوا على البر والتقوى ولا تعاونوا على الإثم والعدوان. So Allah Ta'ala says, after telling the leaders, be just, telling the believers, the masses, to obey those just leaders, And then Allah Ta'ala tells all to cooperate in goodness and piety and do not cooperate in sin and enmity. So we can look at many texts from the Quran, from the Sunnah of the Messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, where this elite mass dichotomy is mentioned. And it also implies that this elite is a small percentage of people, and the masses represent the overwhelming majority. One indication of that is one of the words that has tremendous political relevance is sada yasudu, which can mean rain. So in Arabic language, usually when they're talking, scholars are talking about a political system, they'll say hadhan nidham sa'idun fi baladin ma, that this administration or system is reigning in a particular land. By way of example, and nidham is sa'id, and from this we get sayyid. And one of the definitions of sayyid, as mentioned by Ibn Manzur in Lisan al-Arab, as sayyidu yasudu sawad al-nas. So the sayyid, in this context, the political leader, is one who reigns or rules over the mass of the people. Yasudu sawad al-nas. So sawad from aswad, so when there's a mass, an undifferentiated mass, such as birds, you see them coming over the horizon, it's a black mass. So from that we get sawad. So as-sawad al-azam, sawad al-nas. So the overwhelming mass of the people. So the sayyid, one of the meanings of sayyid, and at our class last night went into many others, one of the meanings, as sayyidu yasudu sawad al-nas, is the one who rules over the mass of the people. So this is something that indicates not only is this mass dichotomy, a mass elite dichotomy prevalent, but it indicates that this elite is a small group and the masses represent a far, far larger group. Now, something else that's relevant in this verse, and perhaps a separate lecture, we can look at this in terms of the sunnah of Allah, how Allah Ta'ala deals with nations. One of the things that this verse implies is Allah's intervention in the political process or in historical affairs. And an example of that, and let me mention the verse, Allah Ta'ala says, elite masses also, but also divine intervention in the historical process. So another verse we'll mention in terms of making clear this elite mass dichotomy. Allah Ta'ala mentions in the Quran, وَكَذَلِكَ نُوَلِّي بَعْضَ الظَّالِمِينَ بَعْضًا. So thus do we give some oppressors rule over others, بِمَا كَانُوا يَكْسِبُونَ. وَكَذَلِكَ نُوَلِّي بَعْضَ الظَّالِمِينَ بَعْضًا بِمَا كَانُوا يَكْسِبُونَ. Thus do we give some oppressors authority over others based on what they themselves have earned. So Allah Ta'ala, and this is, so we get the elites, بَعْضَ الظَّالِمِينَ, the masses, بَعْضَ. So some we give rule over others, بِمَا كَانُوا يَكْسِبُونَ, because of what the latter have earned. But the idea of divine intervention in history. وَكَذَلِكَ نُوَلِّي. So Allah Ta'ala says, thus do we, the royal we. So al-uslub al-maliki. So referring to Allah singularly, but magnifying His station. And this is the best understanding. Some people, they read, وَكَذَلِكَ نُوَلِّي. Oh, Allah and the angels, but that analysis breaks down. And that when we say, وَخَلَقْنَا السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ, so did the angels and all of these other forces participate in the creation of heaven and earth? Allah Ta'ala created the heavens and earth. In any case, so Allah says, نُوَلِّي, we give authority to some over others. So there's divine intervention in the historical process. And this is something we should be cognizant of as we try to understand history. And again, this is something we can talk about in great detail in terms of the sunnah of Allah. The idea of a small group ruling and the large body and mass being ruled over is also reinforced by the idea in classical Muslim political system, or theory rather, of a group that's referred to in terms of selecting the leadership, Ahlul Hal wal Aqd. So the people who loose, Hal, Yuhullu, and bind, or Yaqid, the people who loose and bind. And so those people are the elite who would be somewhat, to a certain extent, not in terms of how they're elected, but in the role that they perform to our American Electoral College. So Electoral College are an elite who are selected, who actually choose the president. So the Electoral College, and there have been instances where the Electoral College has gone against the popular vote. Generally it doesn't, but in theory it can. Because why? The founding fathers determined that the masses can't be totally trusted. So we might have a firebrand, like a Ron Paul, for example. Not endorsing Ron Paul. For example, who people might say, you know, no income tax sounds like a great idea. And eliminating the Fed, a private bank that holds our entire financial system hostage, that has absolutely no public control, might not be a bad idea. And so the people might elect someone like a Ron Paul, seeing that, thinking all of these things aren't bad ideas at all. Then the Electoral College says electing Ron Paul is a bad idea. Because we work for the Fed. And we work. And we benefit from that income tax. So you know what? We feel it's much wiser that as opposed to a president like Ron Paul, that America has a CEO like Mitt Romney. So that's your president, folks. That can happen in theory. The point is, though, those people who are bankers, who are public figures, who are wealthy individuals, who are business people, those are the people who are the constitute the Electoral College. A similar strata of Muslim society are the people who constitute Ahlul Hal wal Aqd. And they are the people who are charged in the classical political theory of choosing the sultan. And that's not always the case. There are other methods, but the classical presentation of the idea. So the idea of Allah Ta'ala intervening in history is a real idea. And again, this, to elaborate on it, require a separate presentation. Also, that people, the action of people, is part of the process of how Allah affects outcomes. So the first verse, the earlier verse we mentioned, وَكَذَلِكَ نُوَلِّي, so Allah Ta'ala says, we place some oppressors over others. بَعْضَ الظَّالِمِينَ بَعْضَ بِمَا كَانُوا يَكْسِبُونَ, based on what they themselves have earned. So the actions of the people are part of this process of tawliyah that Allah Ta'ala refers to here. The process of putting those in charge because of what they have earned. Ultimately, it's from Allah Subhanahu Wa Ta'ala. But the actions of the people play a role. And this is again illustrated in another verse that makes it clear and is more commonly referenced in this context. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُغَيِّرُ مَا بِقَوْمٍ حَتَّى يُغَيِّرُوا مَا بِأَنفُسِهِمْ. Allah will not change the state of a people until they change what is in themselves. So Allah Ta'ala ultimately is affecting the change, but the people's actions and their state has a role in that process. Inna Allaha wa kadhalika nuwalli. Inna Allaha la yughayyiru ma biqawmin hatta yughayyiru ma bianfusihim. Allah will not change the state of a people until they change that which is within themselves. So again, this is a separate issue. We just wanted to touch on these points to give insight into the idea of elite mass, that dichotomy being something that's recognized and that has import in classical Muslim political theory, and a very big import. And again, this could possibly be a separate talk. But what I want to do for the balance of this particular talk is to go back to our contemporary events and back to the subject of the question of what can the masses do. So answering this question, I call your attention to two recent events. One we've referred to already, and that is President Obama rejecting the Keystone XL pipeline. The second, the recall of Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, the recall petition. So each of these events gives us tremendous insight into the nature of mass action and the potential efficacy of mass action, in that in each of these instances, very powerful and entrenched elites, in the former case, Big Oil, which lobbied Congress to the tune of 42 oil companies, lobbying Congress with $60 million to get the XL pipeline through. And so when you see Jim Boehner with his game face on, saying this fight isn't over and we're going to get this pipeline, and even today they're reviving the fight, you know why. As a popular singing group once said, sometimes I wish I was the president so I could show you how your money is spent. Why can't we be friends? So that's how your money's spent. And that's why you have people lining up ready to fight, because they're getting phone calls. I didn't pay you to lose this battle. I paid you to win. So they're in it to win it. But a different outcome for now prevailed. So in that, it was possible, maybe temporarily, to defeat the pipeline despite the money, the influence, the lobbying, the pressure from Big Oil, despite the congressional strength of the Republican Party, who lined up across the board against the project. So how is it possible to defeat it? It was possible to defeat it by doing several things. One, developing a grassroots movement, bipartisan grassroots movement. So this is the first thing, particularly in which state? XL Pipeline, Keystone XL Pipeline, the state of Nebraska. Why a bipartisan movement? The sand hills in Nebraska are prime grazing land. So there are a lot of ranchers there. Ranchers tend to be Republicans. They like to chew tobacco too. So you have Republican ranchers who said, you're not bringing a pipeline through my ranch. Secondly, the sand hills are a national treasure and one of the great sources of pride for Nebraskans. This very unique landscape, very unique ecosystem. The second thing, the sand hills are located over a massive aquifer, one of the largest aquifers in the United States, the Ogallala Aquifer. And so environmentalists, ranchers, homeowners, virtually all of their drinking water, all of their irrigation water, all of the water to water their livestock comes from that aquifer. One oil spill and the aquifer, it's not like oil going on the surface of the ocean, which causes enough damage, but eventually some of it through the sunlight, the movement of the waves, it breaks up. Oil that sinks in underground into an aquifer, there's no escape. That aquifer is ruined. So environmentalists, the ranchers, the homeowners who get their drinking water from the Ogallala Aquifer all came together, formed the grassroots movement that joined with other activists from the environmentalist community to do several things. One thing, high-profile demonstrations and mass public actions focused on the White House itself. So last fall, if you recall, there were massive demonstrations. There was a human chain that was constructed around the White House. And I believe it was several layers deep. There were so many people participating to protest, to urge, because President Obama, by executive order, could end the pipeline. So TransCanada is trying to bring the tar sands, some of the dirtiest oil on earth, from northern Canada, northern Alberta, primarily down through the center of America to the Gulf, to do what? To help meet America's energy needs? No, to be exported to foreign nations. So the whole idea that this pipeline is critical for America's energy security is a lie. This pipeline is critical for oil companies to be able to export this oil internationally to the highest bidder. The idea the pipeline will create jobs. It will create 1,000 to 1,400 temporary jobs. How many people does it take to lay a pipeline? Need the crane operator, the truckers bring the pipes in. So you're not creating any significant number of jobs. Hence the argument, bipartisan, that this is not good for the economy and is potentially ecologically disastrous. So that's one thing they were able to do. The second thing, to build this grassroots movement that focused on high-profile actions at a very identifiable place, the White House. So it was hard to keep those actions out of the news. The second thing, the activists working at the grassroots, especially locally in Nebraska, were able to do were to network with national organizations such as the Friends of the Earth, the Sierra Club, and other environmental groups that have a massive nationwide constituency and also have significant money to help assist in publicity and educational campaigns. So these are two critical factors. Grassroots movement, number one, and forming coalitions with established organizations. Those grassroots movements are generally spontaneous. When that spontaneity and the energy that spontaneity involves links with established organizations, their financial and human resources, votes and money, then great things happen. The second issue, the petition to recall Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin. The Republican Governor Scott Walker won the last gubernatorial election in Wisconsin. But he very quickly betrayed the voters by hastily working to implement the agenda of big business, of corporate America. Specifically, and we see this happening all over the country, eliminating public unions and eliminating collective bargaining, which if it's eliminated will effectively destroy public unions. So destroying public unions, why would that be such a big priority for big business? Mahasan. to destroy public unions, to destroy collective bargaining. Why would that be such a big priority for big business? Exactly. If I have to bargain with the company as an individual, I only have so much weight. Even if I weigh more than Harun, I still only have so much weight. But if I'm bargaining with thousands of other individuals collectively, my weight increases exponentially. And my ability to gain concessions that are beneficial to the working individual increase exponentially. That's one thing. Another thing, if I'm able to eliminate public collective bargaining and therefore destroy one of the last remaining rationales for the existence of a union, what do I effectively do? Consider, I'll give you a clue. Consider the chart of the principal funders of the respective political parties. Who are the principal big money contributors to the Democratic Party? Class. Stockfellow. Say it. The unions. Remember that chart? Unions, all of these unions and the millions they give. The AFL-CIO, Fatima, remember that? Yeah, see, you're just holding back. Shyness is a part of faith. Al-Haya min al-Iman. Allahu Akbar. فَنَشْهَدْ جَمِيعًا بِأَنَّكِ مُؤْمِنَةً وَالْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ نعم. So, you deny the Democratic Party, which for the last 60, 70 years has been the principal defender, more effectively in the earlier part of that period than the latter, of workers in this country. And then there's nothing to stop the corporations from doing their will. So this was a big priority. Scott Walker immediately began to take steps to eliminate public unions, teachers' unions, government workers' unions, and collective bargaining. And the people reacted with the two things that were effective in the campaign to stop the pipeline. A massive grassroots movement that focused on a high-profile location that was impossible to keep out of the news. What was that location? The Wisconsin Capitol Building. The people occupied the Capitol building and took over the headlines for several weeks. So a massive grassroots movement, and then they linked with national unions and tapped into their reservoir of votes and money. And as a result, you got the largest recall petition in the history of the United States. To give you an example, how large, how many times larger is California than Wisconsin? So California, what, 38 million people? Wisconsin, what, 5-6 million, let's say. I don't know exactly, folks. So you guys don't know. Astaghfirullah. But let's say California is six times larger than Wisconsin. That's not unrealistic. California being six times larger, the recall of Gray Davis was based on a petition of 500,000 voters. The recall of Scott Walker in Wisconsin, the petition had over 1 million registered voters. Over half of those who voted in the general election. So this is unprecedented in terms of the numbers. What made that possible? A grassroots movement that focused on a very newsworthy location combined with joining forces with nationwide organizations and tapping into their reservoir of human and financial strength. So from this, we can get insight into what's necessary for the masses to have an effective impact on our political system. Grassroots movements that are capable of generating a lot of media attention and that alert the political elites. So the political elites in Wisconsin and the political elites in Washington, D.C., in the case of the pipeline, particularly the president who had that power, were alerted. We have an alternative set of elites behind us who support our issue. And we also have a lot of votes. And so there will be political consequences if this issue is not resolved in a way that's pleasing to our interests. And so this is very important. These two factors couple with the third. In each of these instances, the grassroots campaigns, in addition to their networking activities, were able to start a national conversation. And this is very important. This is something the Occupy movement has done. So the Occupy movement, in terms of tangible political change, has done very little. But the Occupy movement has sparked a discussion around the growing inequality between the rich and poor that exists in this country. And that discussion made its way to the president's address. One of the most significant things he talked about specifically, without mentioning the Occupy movement, was the growing inequality in this country and its implications for the future stability of the country. And the future stability, if you listen to the speech, you heard President Obama over and over refer to an America that's built to last. Familiar, an America that's built to last. Same future stability. An America that's going to be stable is going to have to be aware of this dichotomy between the growing disparity between the wealth of the elites and the increasing poverty of the masses. Because what does this lead to historically? Does it lead to mass rule? Historically, it leads to revolution. And revolution leads to one set of elite, be that Lenin's vanguard party, disposing with another set, be that the czar and the political infrastructure around the czar, be that the nationalist regime in China, being replaced by the Chinese Communist Party under Mao Zedong. So a new elite threatens to come to power. So the reigning elites began to seriously consider, how can we resolve this issue in a way that will be acceptable to those who are bringing pressure on the system and acceptable to those elites that dominate the system. And so conciliatory elites. In the late 1800s, the early part of the 20th century, there was a very powerful socialist movement here in the United States. They had presidential candidates. They had some of the most widely circulated national newspapers and magazines and other publications. They had very charismatic figures such as Eugene Debs and others. There was a viable Communist Party. And the pressure that they generated in the system could have been potentially revolutionary pressure. But that pressure was diffused. How was it diffused? It was diffused through the New Deal. What was the New Deal? The New Deal was a compromise with the workers and the organizations representing the workers, but a compromise that allowed the elites who dominated the system to maintain their position within the system. If that compromise wasn't made, there possibly could have been a revolution in this country. And then, as opposed to the New Deal, maybe you would have had a socialist or communist regime. So understanding those dynamics and then petitioning the elites in a way that alert them to the importance of their compromising on the issue is critical. The argument is made now because the elites feel they're so powerful and so unchallenged because there's not a viable socialist movement and there's not a communist movement to speak of. There's not any significant populist movement. They can do what they want. And so these inequalities can continue to grow. This is a very, very dangerous situation, but a conversation has started. Now, I'm going to stop here, but building on this foundation, we want to look at, in the context of a grassroots movement, in the context of linking effectively with established organizations, and then in the context of starting a national conversation around issues of relevance to American Muslims, but issues that transcend the Muslim community, how Muslims can begin to develop a meaningful American Muslim politics. So that's the subject of the final lecture in this two-part series. I'm going to stop here, and then we'll open the floor for some discussions, some questions, some answers, some food for thought, inshallah ta'ala. May Allah ta'ala give you all tawfiq. May Allah bless you, bless your families, bless your studies. May Allah ta'ala bless your efforts to draw near to Him, which is a big part of our life, and so it should be a big part of everything that we do, including our academic endeavors. So we'll stop here. That's the next talk. So the next talk on this basis, foundation that we endeavor to lead up to, culminating with the idea that these two very effective mass grassroots campaigns that represented the interest of the masses, why they were effective. We said grassroots movement that is newsworthy because it was structured in a way to focus on very newsworthy locations, the White House and the Wisconsin State House. Secondly, developing meaningful alliances and common ground with established organizations and therefore being able to utilize their networks of human and financial resources. And thirdly, starting a national conversation. So in each of these instances, a national conversation ensued. In the instance of the pipeline, what is the ultimate interest? What price should we be willing to pay ecologically for an imagined energy security? Because at the end of the day, oil and gas are stopgap measures. So this conversation has started, and in the latter instance, do we have to balance state budgets on the backs of working people? Can we begin to envision a political situation where workers have no ability to come together collectively to enhance their power? So again, these are national conversations that were catalyzed by these two events. Is it possible for Muslims here in America to engage in similar political organizing? That's the subject of the next talk. So any questions, comments, additions, subtractions, deletions, food for thought? Yes.
Thank you. level, or to try to do that nationally? Because it seems like movement like Occupy, like it becomes so general that obviously there are main points about it that, you know, trying to affect change in certain arenas, but it just becomes like this very sort of generalized movement where you're just like against.
Right. It has to start locally. This is critical, and this is why we focused on these two events. The Wisconsin, the movement there started locally in Wisconsin, right there in Madison at the State House. And the XL pipeline is started locally in Nebraska. If it weren't for the activists in Nebraska building a bipartisan opposition to the pipeline, it would have gone through. But when it became clear that the governor, his job was in jeopardy, every state senator who supported the pipeline openly, their jobs are in jeopardy, and the U.S. representatives in the House and the Senate, their jobs are in jeopardy, the message was sent, and a response was garnered. So it's critical to start locally. At the end of the day, as it's often said, all politics are local. So it's absolute, and that's a very astute assessment of the Occupy movement, one of its shortcomings. Yes. Anything else? Yes. Should we mic do strange music? No, to fuck.
I know I'm uninformed, but when I do follow, I feel like I'm misinformed. Mm-hmm. And like something like you pointed out, like if like a random governor in like Rhode Island is to be like dismissed or displaced or something, like I can't figure out what that means. Like in like the big scheme of things, like how am I supposed to, like if I go on CNN or something, it's just the same thing. Like everything is, it's the same news. How do I guess, piece together everything that's going on?
That's the whole point of an uncommon introduction. The question is stated that sometimes there are people who, when they don't follow politics, they feel they're uninformed. And when they follow politics through conventional means, they feel, and media, they feel they're misinformed. So what is one to do if one finds oneself in that situation? This is goes back to an uncommon introduction to American politics. How can we develop a theoretical framework that informs us as to what's really going on? And once we have that theoretical framework, that framework then allows us to understand, to view, and to interpret issues and events. So it's very important to have some sort of theoretical framework, and that framework is as balanced as possible, and then using that framework to understand what's going on. And so then when we see the media and we see that there's certain messages that are repeated over and over again, when we hear politicians speak, there's certain buzzwords that are repeated over and over again. Why does every time President Obama gives a major address, be it in Cairo or be it in the State of the Union, there has to be a statement of our ironclad commitment to Israel's security? Why? So if we understand the role of interest groups and how they influence the system, even if they represent a small constituency, then we can understand not only AIPAC in terms of American-Israeli relations, we can understand the NRA, the National Rifle Association, which is considered the most influential and powerful interest group in Washington, D.C. And we can understand why whenever there's one of these mass killings, what do we have right after the mass killing, be it in Columbine, be it in Arkansas, be it wherever? What do you have right after? You have a rally. They brought Charlton Heston to Colorado to affirm the rights of Americans to bear arms. In other words, the NRA is protecting your right to bear arms, even if someone who's bearing arms just went and shot up a school or a university campus. Don't allow this to let them, big government, take your guns. And so, understanding how these interest groups work, we can understand why politicians make these statements. And we can understand why no one in Washington will take on the NRA. And so the most important thing is to get a theoretical framework where we can understand how interest groups influence the system, how Congress actually works, what is the role of the president in arbitrating between conflicting interests. And once we have that theoretical framework, then we can begin to understand meaningfully what's going on in the news. And when we can say confidently, be it the president's speech, be it a bill that's passed, be it a bailout, that's a bunch of BS. And I know it's a bunch of BS because the framework that I've developed to assess and analyze these events leads me to understand why that's being said, why what's actually being stated is not a reflection of the interests that are being served. And not a reflection, rather, of the interest of the people at large. So developing a theoretical framework allows us to see beyond the news. Haroon has his hand up. You had your hand up. Oh, you just said, okay. Musab.
What if someone says that bailout helped GM and they use that as... They say the
bailout helped GM? At least you could argue that ordinary people were able to keep some of their jobs.
You say this whole thing is a war on information, and now that we have the resources, like, you know, the internet, and free for everyone, movements like SOPA and PITA, they're kind of trying to, you know, have another agenda.
I think those are good examples. So these efforts to, in the name of stopping piracy, censor the internet. It generated a lot of resistance. But did the most effective resistance come from the masses or elites? From the masses? So you and I saying we're against this bill was more effective than Wikipedia and Google shutting down for a day? Wikipedia and Google, mass or elite? Elite, small group of individuals. That was far more effective and sent a far more powerful message than 200 million angry Americans. Because Google represents a lot of money. And Wikipedia represents a lot of people. How many people use it every day? So when Wikipedia says, listen, we're upset, that carries a lot more weight than just 200 million unorganized people saying we're upset. Because Wikipedia now can translate that mass unrest into tangible political proposals, which they did. And were the opposing elites responsive? In fact, that was the third issue I wanted to mention. Were the opposing elites responsive? They were responsive. One bill died and the other one is reformulated to such an extent it's unrecognizable and will probably die also. So they were responsive. And so I think that illustrates the point we were trying to make earlier. One more question. It's time for Margaret. Yes, sir.
So this one comes from Rashid Dar on our Facebook page. Question, does Imam Zaid feel that Muslims ought to hold unified political opinions, in other words, their own platform? Like, I feel Muslims too often cleave to the left due to the xenophobia of the right. But take that away, and I think there's good room for having different positions on issues and policies. I just fear a, quote, Muslim group think and wonder what Imam Zaid has to say about that.
That's an excellent question. I think it's very important for us as Muslims, as a community, to see what positions are in the interest of our community and how those intersect with other communities out there, and then begin building coalitions based on that agenda. And in some issues, we might come down to the right, and other issues, we might come down to the left. Generally, socially, Muslims tend to come down on the right, and politically, especially in foreign policy, Muslims tend to come down on the left. And you see that clearly. Before September 11th and the subsequent war on Muslim countries and the draconian measures directed indirectly. Now, I don't know how you get away with that, but I'll do it anyway. Directed indirectly at the Muslim community. I say that because directly, the Patriot Act, the recent indefinite detention, all that's not directly directed at Muslims. The latter is directed at a disappearing middle class. Their homes keep disappearing. Their savings keep disappearing. Their retirement funds disappearing. What do you think those rifle-owning, red-blooded Americans are going to do sooner or later? They're going to start organizing militias and maybe start a revolt. So this is telling you, if you get serious about organizing, you'll be detained indefinitely because you'll be labeled as a supporter of terrorism. That's the ultimate target. The Patriot Act and the detention and deportation pushed through, rushed through, ostensibly in the name of fighting the Muslim threat. Who, though, has it been directed against? The Latino community. Over the last 2 years alone, over 1 million Latinos have been detained and deported under Obama. So this is why I say directly, it's only indirectly directed at the Muslim community. And saying that, I confused myself and lost my point. What was that? What was the question?
Whether they should.
Right. So before September 11th and all these indirect, direct attacks on the Muslim community, Muslims were unified to the right. At least most Muslims of immigrant backgrounds supported the Grand Old Party, the GOP. Muslims took great pride in being the kingmakers. We had a 60,000 Muslim block vote in Florida for Bush. 18 months later, that pride dissipated. Less than a year later, actually. It was our fault. Those 60,000 votes aren't there. Gore wins. Gore's president. Bush is not selected by the Supreme Court. But Muslims were to the right. So that liberal bias wasn't there. After September 11th and all of these measures directly and indirectly targeting the Muslim community, Muslims shifted to the left. And political concerns, especially foreign policy and security-related issues, became a primary concern. And 90% of the Muslims who voted and 2008 voted for President Obama. So I think these are real issues, but it only shows that people ultimately will vote on what they perceive to be their interest. What it behooves us as a community to do is to look at our interests more systematically And then as opposed to responding in an ex post facto manner to events and in a priori fashion develop our own agenda, see where are those, what common programs, policies we share with others, and then build alliances with those others. And inshallah, this is what the next lecture will focus on specifically, because we really want to look at this issue in a concrete way and present some concrete, inshallah, thought out recommendations in that regard. So on that note, we bid you all a wonderful evening. May you be blessed. May you be too blessed to ever be stressed. And may your comfort and relaxation allow you to successfully pass every test. Walhamdulillah, wassalat, wassalam, ala rasulillah. Again, reminding anyone, if you're going to be anywhere near San Jose, California, February 18th, around 6:30 p.m., then come by the Fairmont of San Jose, so you can participate in building Zaytuna College brick by brick by brick. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Want to remind all of you online and of course all the students, please keep Zaytuna in your du'as. We could certainly use them. Also consider financial support and at least showing up to the to the banquet in San Jose on February 18th. And thirdly, please get the word out and consider applying if you have not done so. All information can be found on the Zaytuna website or the Zaytuna Facebook page. And check both of those places for upcoming announcements about the other lectures in the co-founder lecture series.